Every day there is a forgetting, and every moment there is the possibility of remembering. Remembering who you truly are, awakening to your body, to the inner world and experience of being alive. Here is where you find the beauty, the joy. Here is where you free your soma. Welcome, everyone, to the Free Your Soma podcast. Today's subject is going to be sound healing, and specifically this incredible frequency that I just learned about called A432 Hertz. I have an amazing sound healer and professional musician here today to share with us his knowledge and experience about this frequency, as well as just the capacity that music has to shift our moods, to shift our consciousness, and to help us potentially connect deeper with our bodies and the earth and the life around us. So welcome. This is Steven Rubio. Thank you for coming on for your Soma today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Amy. I'm so excited about this.
Great. Yeah. You know, I really, Steven Rubio did a TEDx talk on the subject of A432 Hertz. You can actually see it on YouTube, which is pretty cool for anybody who wants to Google that. And I'm sure we'll cover some of the same general information here today, but we're going to go a little bit deeper with it. We're going to talk a bit more about the connection between this frequency and the work that you do as a musician. So first off, tell me just a little bit, how did you come about knowing about 432 Hertz?
Well, I don't remember exactly how I came across it, but I think, you know, just me being open to that information is part of it, because if you're not wanting to change, if you're not wanting to find out more, what could be better, what could be more, if you're not always trying to push the limits with what you're doing in your art form, then you might not be so receptive to someone telling you that maybe you've been tuning your instrument the wrong way your whole entire life. Or maybe the music teachers at your music school have been telling you a slightly different way, and there's a better way. So I'm pretty sure that must have been through, you know, I love conspiracy theories, and A432 kind of goes into conspiracy theory at certain points of it. Dealing with, you know, people say that Hitler and the Nazis and were in control of, you know, and the Schiller Institute were the ones who wanted to make A440 the concert pitch standard. So I don't know. I think just wanting to go down these rabbit holes, finding this information on the internet and coming across different websites that were claiming that this was this magical frequency. And for me, it's like, okay, prove it, you know, let's research, let's find out.
Right. And so you've been really doing your own experimentation with this frequency since kind of your gaining of awareness about it. Right. And it sounds like you're somebody who enjoys thinking outside the box, you know, with these conspiracy theories and different ways of understanding, like, stuff that sometimes might seem kind of bizarre and unexplainable. So
right.
Tell me a little bit more, like, as you begin to work with this frequency, because you have a pretty significant background in music, right? Would you tell us a little bit about your background in music?
Sure. So, you know, I come from a family of musicians. My dad's a drummer. My mom was a singer. I would always see them playing in their band when growing up, you know. And my uncle's a saxophone player. He's taught. He used to be the main music teacher up here for so long. I have other family musicians. My brother's a musician. So it was just growing up with that influence was super helpful, even if you're not practicing or playing per se, but just hearing someone play or hearing. So I was always involved around music. My parents listened to great music. They would sometimes even quiz me. Okay. You know, the song would be coming to an end and they would quiz me. Okay. What's the next song on the album? You know, before the next song comes up, what's the next song? and put you on the spot. You're supposed to know the song order of an album. That's weird. That's not normal. You know I came from a not normal sort of musician childhood. But really my musicianship, I guess you could say, started when I was around the age of 13. I didn't really take private lessons from my dad. You would think I would have taken advantage of that a little more and gotten, but I was a decent drummer by the age of 13, but I hadn't done any training. So in high school, I got involved with all the bands, the marching band, the concert band, jazz band. And we had an award-winning, all of our bands were actually award-winning. We had a great school, great marching band and great drum line. And so I just was like, you know what, this is what I want to do. It was either video games or art or music. And I knew that, you know, I wasn't that great at art. Video games, it was just, okay, that's kind of a hobby.
And well, you can make money on it now, but we didn't know that back then, right?
Right. And you can make money at all those things, definitely. But I had to really follow my heart. And so my dad funded me to go to Musicians Institute, which was really nice of him. And I did what any son would want there, or, you know, I did what they would want me to do, which is just soak it up. I kept all the curriculum. I graduated from Musicians Institute in 2010. And that was for drums. I got a little bit of recording experience there. Up until that point, though, everything was A440, you know, and in my head, there was no other tuning. I didn't, you know, you don't really think of another frequency tuning because all of your instruments default to A440, and everything you do in your computer stuff, it just is A440. Every tuner you turn on, everything defaults that way. So why not? Why should I tune it differently? And until you find out about this extra little information that might be out there, you don't even really know it's there, which is interesting.
Right. Well, just out of curiosity, to go down, like, maybe just slightly, like, peek our head in one of those rabbit holes, what would be like the difference between 440 and, you know, 432, in terms of, like, does 440 have some kind of resonance that's, like, more subdued, or what effect does 440 have on, like, humanity if 432 is so healing?
Well, some people say that, you know, 440 is kind of dissonant, or that it at least it isn't as harmonious as 432. I've heard a quote where they said 432 hertz touches all 12 harmonic octaves, whereas A440 only touches 8 out of those 12 harmonic octaves. You know, and I'm a drummer, I can't quite explain exactly what that means, but what I do feel and what I do know from playing in this tuning and listening and really feeling, listening, but also how does this make me feel? How do I feel when I play this chord? How do I feel when I listen to this music? It's a really subtle difference. It's something that you know, musicians, I can't tell. Sometimes I think a song is 432 and I test it and it's not. And I might really love that song in A440, and I might really feel some great feelings from that. But in general, what I feel from 432 is I feel it's more, I would say more round. If you were to give it like a visual, it's more, it's a little bit more relaxed, more, what's the word? More complete, more whole, more, less jagged, less aggressive. And you can really feel it in the songs and albums that are in 432, in my opinion. It really is something that I think musicians and non-musicians can feel. And we've also been voting with our ears and we don't know it, you know, with these album sales. When you look at the top album sales, and the greatest selling album of all time is an A432 hertz. So we've already voted.
What album is that?
That's Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Oh, okay. I wonder if and, he knew anything about it. Do you think he did that on purpose, or?
Well, I know that they did that on purpose. Okay. I know that, you know, because you can't, if you tuned by ear, which is what back in the 60s and 70s, a lot of times they would maybe hit the key on the piano, or someone would hit a note and they would all tune to that note. Now that note might be an A438 or A430 or A437, but to make it exactly A432, right on the dot, every song, that's not an accident, because like I said, everything's defaulted to A440. So when they turned on that analog synthesizer and we're going to add some tunes to the, beat it or whatever, they had to mess around with it to get it to be A432. It was not an accident.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of wonder, like, cause you're saying it has this round tone, like maybe they were just like sliding the numbers and just being like, what sounds better? Ooh, I like that one. Like they had some feeling come across, like maybe it was intentional and they knew about all this stuff, or maybe it was like just this intuitive thing where they like felt like, oh, I like it. Just right there. Like don't turn it any higher. You know?
Right. It's interesting, because they're not saying that. You look on the album, I have the vinyl record, and you go through the liner notes, you look at the back, I'm trying to look at interviews on YouTube. I want to hear Quincy Jones telling me like, yeah, we used A432 because blah, blah, blah. And there's really just nothing. It's either they never had that interview, they never spoke about it, no one ever labeled it A432. It took, 40 years and a nerd like me to kind of figure it out. And I had something else I was going to say to that. I think, Beat It is on that album, I'm pretty sure. Mm-hmm. And Eddie Van Halen plays the guitar solo. And if you listen to the first two Van Halen albums, they're all in A432. So I can't help but wonder, did Eddie Van Halen bring this knowledge into Michael Jackson's life and go, hey, let's try this, mm-hmm. Or did Quincy Jones go, hey, Michael, you're up here in this range way up here. Let's just lower that frequency just a little bit and make it a little bit easier to sing. Ah. And that's one of the things about A432 that a lot of, you can see interviews of Italian opera singers and people, saying that, yes, when you lower the pitch, and we're not talking about just going a half step down, because that's a common thing to do. We're talking about changing the frequency center and making it just that 8 hertz lower. When you try to hit those upper notes, it's not such a strain on your vocal cords, and you wind up injuring yourself way less often if you sing to A432, supposedly.
So. Fascinating. Wow. Yeah. Well, in terms of like the healing capacity of this frequency, what have you experienced like with, because what you do is so interesting. You layer instruments on top of each other. Like you have a variety of different instruments, and then you layer them using a loop, right? That's what that's your method. Right.
Yeah.
When you're doing this with multiple instruments and they're all tuned to this A432, like you probably get a very strong frequency in the space because everything's tuned into that and you've got these really intricate kinds of layers going on. What do you feel like personally, you experience after an hour of just being absorbed in this frequency?
Well, yeah. So when I do these sound baths and they're all in A432, I feel so relaxed afterwards. You can't help it. There's definitely a part of it. You're giving this sound healing energy. But your body and your biofield is receiving that energy as well. Everyone in the room is feeling it. And so, it's just sort of this calm feeling. There's a lot of times where actually I'm a little bit nervous at the beginning and my heart's racing a little bit, and and sometimes I'm trying to talk over some of the music that I'm doing and just get people to guide their own breath down, and I'm literally having to guide my own my own breath and calm myself down, and the music that's playing alongside it definitely helps when you layer, and when you have that frequency range. When I mean frequency range, your low bass frequencies to your high trebly hi-hats and cymbal frequencies, and everything in between. When I layer a bass layer and it's nice and calm, that's nice in the bass range. Then I get like a mid-tone going, And that's kind of nice in the mid range. And then I might do something up high or have a bell or something. So you're getting a full frequency range of A432. And I want to reiterate too that, you know, just because the song isn't tuned to the, or it's not in the key of A, or, you know, it's, let's say the song is in the key of D, and you're still playing in A432 hertz tuning, you're using the A432 hertz tuning set, which itself has, that's where the healing power comes from. Mm-hmm. It's not that you have to tune every song to A or have 432 hertz playing on every song as well, or even octaves of that. Yeah, anything within that tuning set is going to be supposedly, and what I feel and what I believe, is more helpful than our current concert pitch standard of A440.
Yeah, wow, that's super fascinating. I mean, you know, this idea, you know, I think most of us just assume that sound baths are supposed to be relaxing, but I actually learned recently, and I had some experiences early on, that there are different kinds of sound bath techniques and that not all of them are supposed to be relaxing. There are some that are actually supposed to be kind of aggravating or like stimulating or like triggering.
Totally.
Like there was a sound healer that I heard about recently who works with gongs, and he said something fascinating about gongs that I didn't know about before, which is that the sound of a metal bowl and a gong is actually sometimes very abrasive to our nervous system, and we feel like impacted by it, and this, it's a little rough on us, so to speak, right? And
totally.
Then shamanic sound baths that I've been to a few, where they use very kind of strange like ticking noises or these like sharp sounds to kind of like, you know, remind you of a dream state or take you kind of into another realm, you know, that has some darkness, that has some like edge to it, you know, that is uncomfortable, you know. And frankly, like I've had those experiences after a sound bath where, you know, I expected to go in and like, it's like, I'm going to have this relaxing experience. And instead I come out kind of shaken. Instead I come out kind of like, you know, feeling a little overwhelmed or even feeling a little bit like, ooh, what just happened? Like I'm stirred up inside. And so I find what you just said, even though it seemed very benign, you know, how relaxed you feel afterwards is actually like, it's a specific way of doing a sound bath, with the point being to relax you, not to necessarily stimulate, you know, agitate or stir somebody up. Would you like to say something about that? Because I'm sure you've been exposed to other sound healing work.
Totally. Yeah. So what you're touching on is called entrainment or brain. It's entrainment. Not necessarily brainwave entrainment, which I'll touch on in a second, but musical entrainment, I'm pretty sure, means that you're taking the listener from an agitated state. Usually you want to take them from agitated to relaxed. In your case, you were talking about maybe the opposite happening, where there was some relaxing noise and maybe they ended off with the gongs and the bowls and it left you kind of agitated, which maybe is not such a, it might not be a bad thing. Like we think of agitation as like a negative emotion, but maybe it's agitated something inside of you that needed to be agitated.
For sure.
But yeah, so you can use techniques of, you know, coming out with the music kind of maybe a little bit loud, or maybe even, you know, I've had this idea of using A440 and using something that, you know, if I think it is dissonant, then I should use it that way, right? Like I could use that dissonance and that loudness and that sharpness and that angled sound, and then dip it down to A432 and have more of a relaxing, softer, less busy sort of ambience,
like a juxtaposition, so that people could maybe even sense and feel the difference.
Totally. And then, you know, then you can use brainwave entrainment, and all that means is you're using sound to help align people's brainwaves to that frequency. So I'm sure you've heard of binaural beats, right?
Yeah.
So binaural beats are a form of brainwave entrainment. There's There's binaural beats, there's monaural beats, and there's isochronic tones. And real brief, you know, binaural beats, they're basically panning a tone, one tone to the right ear, one tone to your left ear, and then the frequencies are slightly off, and your brain is creating an auditory illusion. It's not actually happening, but when you have, that's why you have to use headphones with binaural beats. Otherwise they do not work. So you can listen to all the binaural beats you want on YouTube over your speaker system, and it's not going to do anything. It's really not. It might be soothing to you. It might help you relax. You might even fall asleep to it. But anyways, monaural beats, they're just doing the frequency right up the middle, and they're detuning the two tones the same way, but it's just panned right up the middle. So with monaural beats, you don't have to use headphones. And for that reason, and for other reasons that I've found, they seem to be more effective when I've looked into some of the research behind it, when they've tested monaural beats versus binaural beats. I still need to look up more on this, but everything in my mind is kind of like leaning that way. But I really use them because I can go into a yoga class, or I can be alongside a yoga instructor, or do a sound bath, and I don't have to hand out 15 pairs of headphones. Right. Or I don't have to say, hey, bring your headphones for this one. And we're going to figure out a way to hook up all to the Bluetooth and hope and pray that that works for all of us. I'm just going to put the monaural beat into the, I can put it underneath the music that I'm doing, or I can just deliver that monaural beat. It's basically a sine wave. It's a very basic audio wave with no overtones, because if you have overtones, it's going to affect that experience. So I can deliver that, and it takes about 5 to 6 minutes, and then the listener will, their brainwaves will align to whatever frequency I put it at, really. So you can, you know, in theory, you could put someone to sleep. You could make someone feel really agitated and like they're angry and they need to just yell at the world, or you can have them in a meditative state, you know, and anywhere right in between.
Perfect segue into the next question that I actually wanted to address with you, which is just, you're talking about the way that these frequencies, like the one that you just mentioned with 432 hertz or 430 or any various frequencies, that they really literally shift the way our brains are operating. They can make actual measurable changes in our brain waves, and therefore also maybe in our consciousness or our mood or our state of mind. And this is pretty fascinating, because I feel like, you know, when you say it like this, it sounds like this really big deal, except that I think that we've all been experiencing this with music most of our lives, the way that music has this impact on us and the tone, the sound. Sometimes it's, you know, if it's an album, like the recording quality of the music can all evoke a feeling and compel us to
totally
to do things, or to dance, or to cry, or to emote, right, and express, or it can put us to sleep, like you just said.
Totally.
So, would you say a little bit about, you know, because as a professional drummer, I'm sure that you have played in a lot of bars and you've played in a lot of different kinds of scenes, you know, and what do you think is like so contrasting about music in that kind of setting versus a sound healing setting in an environment where we're really focused on sound as a way to nurture ourselves? What would you say are some of the differences?
Well, I would say that there's just a major connection that happens when I am working with 432 hertz, and when I'm working in smaller groups, and when you're working with more silence and space than you are noise, or sound, I should say, lots of sound. It's complete. It's night and day difference. It's so funny that I was just in this cover band where we were, you know, gigging three times a month and playing these bars, and I'm showing up and I'm dragging my drums there and playing till midnight, and I don't drink, but you know, I'm around all these people that are drinking, and then sometimes even the next morning I would be doing a sound bath, you know. And a night and day difference, having to be quiet and calm versus, you know, rocking out on the drums and being loud. And it's a difference in, you know, people are there to either listen to every note that you're doing and be affected by every note, or you're sort of just background music or background noise. Or even if you're there to see the band, you know, there's a lot of times where you're going, oh, hey, how you're talking to your friend, you're, oh, do you want a drink, blah, 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 blah. Because the music is just going by and it's for a different purpose. It's for dancing. It's for, you know, entertainment. It's for, you know, it's for those things. It's not necessarily for healing, but that doesn't mean that when you go see your favorite band or whatever, or even a cover band at the bar, it doesn't mean that that experience is not healing. Because we all know that music itself is healing.
Right.
It just is a different intention behind it. Are you intending to go show off for your friends and make a little bit of money? Or are you intending to really, you know, focus in on these six people and give them something that's real?
Right.
You know?
Well, and this difference can also be just broken down to environment. I mean, you know, like you said, the music itself is healing, and there could be somebody, I'm sure there's somebody out there who like goes to a guar show,
right? And
experiences some therapeutic,
you know, totally. From
it. I am positive that there are folks out there that are, you know, emotionally and psychologically benefited by that experience, right? And of course, it's going to be different for other people, but the environment and the intention of a rock and roll show, you know, or a bar is very different than the intention of like an ashram or a yoga studio, or even like a, you know, temple of some kind, where the intention there is really to connect with healing, to connect with, you know, our bodies, to work through things that show up in a calm and compassionate way, right? Versus
right.
A rock and roll show is letting it all out, you know, expressing, being as big as you want, you know, maybe drinking alcohol to forget your worries, right? It's just,
yeah, there's the disc
so different.
Totally. And, you know, and the disconnect that you can experience from alcohol, you know, you're escaping in a way. You're escaping some of the things that go along with the night of drinking at a bar. You're probably numbing down your ears a bit so you can even endure the volume that's coming from it, you know. At least I know I feel that way. And with sound baths, you're people are there, they're either sober or, you know, maybe they're on some sort of other substance that might be more of a connection based thing, and more of trying to heal and trying to go deeper, and instead of trying to forget and disconnect, they're trying to connect. And I feel that every time I do a sound bath,
right?
You know, versus playing drums at a bar. And you know, ultimately I'd like to play in A432, play drums at some place that is you know, in a band where I can express myself, but not be too loud and not blast everyone out, and everyone has a good time, and it's sort of the best of all worlds. But in my experience, you know, I mentioned this to my friends. I say, hey guys, let's try it. Let's tune your instruments the other way. And bands have tried it here and there. I've recorded a couple songs recently with the band I'm in it that way. And it just didn't stick. And it doesn't, I'm not trying to force it on anyone. I'm not trying to make it stick. But I know that for me, that's all I'm going to play. I'm going to play an A432 the rest of my life. I can feel the difference. I can hear the difference, and the healing from it is amazing. Real quick, I did a tuning fork session, on a friend. Well, first I did the Big Bear Yoga Festival, and that was probably the most people I've had at a sound bath. I think we had maybe 20 to 25 people outside in the sunshine, full sun. And I went around with the tuning fork to each person. And I said, here, take this crystal, hold it up to your wherever you feel you need the most healing. And I'm going to come around with the tuning fork and I'm going to place it on the crystal. And it's going to amplify that vibration into your body.
Mm.
And I did this on everyone. And there were, you know, and I'm not, I would say that surprisingly, I'm not very sensitive to energies. I wish I was. I wish I had that, you know, ability more. But there were a few people where when I did the tuning fork, it was just like, not only a giving of energy, there was like receiving of their energy to me. And I felt some of their trauma or their whatever they were going through at the moment. I had to, whoa, what was that? Take a deep breath, you know? So I had that experience. And then I had a friend, I think I was on my way back from the Big Bear yoga festival, and I had my forks with me, and she had a hurt knee. And it had happened months ago, but she was still dealing with this knee that was just causing her a lot of pain. So I said, okay, let's try it. Let's try the tuning forks. Dinged it over her knee. You know, it's interesting because you're dealing with a person's biofield. You're dealing with this magnetic energy field around them, and the sound and the vibration, you can really feel these pockets of trauma that happen to these people. So I wasn't even touching her. I'm feeling this pocket of energy. And anyways, next morning she texts me and says, hey, I don't have any more pain in my knee. What? That was amazing. I said, really? Are you serious? You know, I thought I would just take away a little bit of her pain. She might feel a little better that night. She might sleep a little better, but I didn't think it would be that effective. So I started buying more tuning forks after that one.
That's so fascinating. I mean, did you come up with that idea of the crystal and the amplification?
No, I read a book called Tuning the Human Biofield by Dr. Eileen McCusick. Yeah, highly recommend that book. She has a new book out. I think it's called Energizing the Body or something like that. It's more about the electrical system in the body. She, in her book, she talks about using crystals to amplify the vibration. I use regular quartz. I believe in her book, she recommends Lemurian seed quartz. And I've looked at that in crystal shops recently, and it's a little pricey. So that might be something I have to save up for. But for now, I'm using the regular quartz, and I know that that will amplify the vibration as well.
Right. So. And the forks are all in 432 hertz. So that vibration is combining with the energy of the crystal.
Right. They're either 432 or, you know, it's like C256, the C note in A432, or it's lower octave 128. They're all just octaves of each other inside of that tuning. And, you know, I keep using them and keep having such positive feedback. I can't help but think that, you know, there's definitely some scientific evidence going on here that needs to be more, it just needs to be explored more. And, you know, when I did the TED talk, I think that was in 2017 now. It was a few years ago. It's been a while. But I had to research. I already knew about A432. But I had to really go, okay, well, now I'm supposed to be somewhat of an expert on this. I'm supposed to be the guy that informs people about this in this 15-minute talk that I have to memorize. Oh, boy. And so I really had to take it seriously and dive even deeper into what I already knew in my heart was better. But now I had to find out, okay, why is this better? Or at least why does it resonate more with me? Or why is the best-selling album of all time in A432? How did that happen? The Disney logo, that old Disney logo on those old Disney films.
The little sound. That's very round, isn't it? It's got the dome.
Totally. And that whistling sound. It's not ear piercing. You would think that it's very calming and invoking. And I put that on and tested it on my keyboard and went, oh my gosh, it's been in my face literally since I was a kid. It's been the best-selling album of all time. It's Van Halen, Bob Marley, you know, Soundgarden, all these bands have utilized it in either their singles or their albums. And it's, you know, you could say, well, yeah, you have to have a great written song, you have to have great musicians, you have to have great production, you have to have all those pieces to the puzzle, obviously. I can't help. My theory is that 432 Hertz gives it that little extra spice, that little extra special boost that resonates more with people, because 432 Hertz is based on sonic geometry. It's based on mathematics. It's based on the fundamentals that basically govern physics and our universe, and that, you know, that we're dealing with on such a micro level and a macro level. It's really amazing. And then my yoga journey has confirmed a lot of the things, you know, with 108 mala beads and 108 statues here, and all of those are just lower octaves of 432 Hertz. When you see the number 108 or 216, all these numbers start really coming into play, making sense. And when you look at 440 and the mathematics of that tuning, it doesn't really make sense. It doesn't resonate with any other,
right,
any other things so much.
You know, I have to wonder just about this way. First of all, let me ask you a bit about the history before I go on about these amazing little pieces that are coming together for me. But 440 Hertz, when was that considered, like, what time period was that, like, the official, now this is what everybody tunes their instruments to? I'm assuming it was a European thing, right? And it was like, at some point in time, do you know?
Yeah, it was between about 1932-ish and 1936 or 1938, and definitely mid 1930s. You know, and it makes sense. You know, if you're a traveling musician and you're coming from, let's say, Europe to America or vice versa, you're gonna want to be able to play in. You're gonna want to play your instrument in tune with your friends in that new country. You don't want to be standing out as the person that's out of tune, right? So if Europe's on A432 and America's on A440 and we want to have a concert together, it's not going to sound very good.
Right. Okay. So there was in the 20th century, then there's been this shift. And how was it before? Like, what was the standard before? Like, there wasn't a standard, like every country or every like culture kind of had their own tuning that they would play in?
Yeah. So they would just, every country kind of had their own different tuning. There was A435 for a bit with France. And before that, there was 430 Hertz. And I think they've tried even lower, 420, whatever. I don't know exactly when they were actually able to measure the Hertz frequency of it. Because if you think about that, well, how did they even measure that? You know, because it has to be an exact number. If you go 437 Hertz versus 438 Hertz, well, you and I are not going to be able to tell the difference of that, really, unless it's side by side right away. But, you know, we're not going to be able to put a number on that. So I think the invention of the tuning fork, I'm not sure if that was the first thing that allowed us to do that, but I need to research more into how that came about. But I do know that eventually in the 20th century there, we just, in the 1930s, we had to, it was like, all right, we're going to make a decision. And that decision was for basically most of the world, or at least the Western world, was like, okay, we're using concert pitch standard A440. Every instrument is going to be tuned to that. And, you know, not only tuned to that, but when you think about the manufacturing process of certain instruments, like the guitar, for example, when you have a guitar, it's intonated to a certain tuning. So almost all the guitars you see on the shelves today are intonated to A440, meaning that the frets and the distances between the strings and the frets and all of that. I'm not really a guitar player, but I know enough that they're making their instruments, they're manufacturing their instruments, the size, the weight, everything is to that tuning. So you can tune that instrument to 432 Hertz. And that's what I'm doing with my guitars. And it sounds great. You might go up to some higher notes and the intonation is off, because that guitar is intonated to a different frequency standard. So ideally, you have to take some of these instruments in and re-intonate them to A432 and then put them in A432 if you really wanted to be
precise,
super precise about it. But really, for everyone, for myself included, for anyone that's trying to play in this tuning, or even A444, if you want to look into that tuning, that's another alternative tuning. Any of these instruments can do it. I have a couple keyboards here that can do it. This keyboard's from the 80s, and it actually just has a tuning dial on the side of it. It's really old school, and it doesn't have, it just has sharp, flat, it with no markings in between. So I had to figure out exactly where A432 was by using another instrument and my ears, and then I just covered up that dial so that it can never be switched from A432. But even this instrument from 1985 can tune to A432. So I would encourage people to at least try it. Take your guitar tuner, change it to 432, play around in it, default your keyboard to 432, try singing along with it if you have some tracks on YouTube or something, because you might notice a difference and you might enjoy what you hear.
Cool. Yeah. You know, the way that you are making this music, you know, with the layers, with the research, you know, you're being very, I would say, deliberate about your approach, which I think is really cool. You're creating something unique and you're gathering all these different pieces to bring into this work. You know, where would you see this going for you? I mean, as you're a yoga teacher, but do you kind of identify more as a musician and more as like, you know, as you're moving from, say, the bar scene into more of like the healing world with this? Like, what do you imagine for, you know, how you'd like to work, how you'd like to transmit this? Do you want to create records? Do you want to do live events? Do you want to work with people like in close, intimate settings? Just kind of curious about that.
Yeah. This is so cool. I love this interview, by the way. This is really neat. I've always thought of recording as, you know, as like when you hear, or when you think of any band that you like or any group that you've heard, you think of those recordings, you think of those songs, you think of usually the studio versions of those songs. And typically the band went into the studio for, or not even studio first, they came up with these songs in the rehearsal spaces first, or song ideas. They sort of polished them up before they went into the studio. They perfected them in the studio, recorded them, and then they went out and said, okay, now we have some songs to play, guys. Now we know what we're doing. And we also have a product. We have a vinyl record or a CD or a cassette, or maybe now we have t-shirts. Something that you can sell alongside of your performance. And that's what I think of as a lot of like the success that we see from, you know, bands like Led Zeppelin or The Who, or, you know, name any band that you can think of. They've had that success mostly because they're so talented and they've worked so hard, but they've also followed this formula of like crafting songs, you know, or crafting what you're doing first. And so I love that idea of recording sound healing music and sort of crafting it in the studio and then releasing it. And when you have a recording or when you have a song that goes out there into the world, well, now it's something that people can listen to over and over again. It's something a lot of people can listen to over and over again. When I do a sound bath for 8 people, those 8 people get that experience in the moment, and it's really high quality because it's in person. It's you're there, and but then it's gone. And so part of what I'm doing with that is I'm recording the live sound baths I'm doing. I've been recording them. It's just been sometimes the performance doesn't go as planned, or sometimes there is someone farts, or, you know, whatever it is, my instrument craps out, or, you know, there's just always a variety of things that happen, and I can edit that out later. But I'm working on doing basically a live sound healing album. Trying to put one out this next year. I've been doing nature samples from this recording device that I have. And as you know, the mountains are a great place to hear beautiful sounds. So I'm working on, like, I've got a stream sound, some thunderstorm sounds, you know, some birds, and really I want to put out music that's useful to people. How are people going to use it?
How do you imagine, like, for meditation? Do you imagine for yoga? Do you imagine for, like, what kind of setting do you imagine the music being played in?
So yeah, I would say for mostly meditation and for yoga, you know, for these instructors that are, you know, searching through their phones on Spotify and going, okay, well, what am I going to play for my next yoga class? I sort of have to put myself in their shoes and go, okay, well, what would I choose? What would I pick? Obviously you don't want to put on Guar or something crazy death metal, right? You want to soothe them into something relaxing. And, you know, I'll go to the thrift shop sometimes and you always come across these, like, these CDs that you're like, oh, nature recording, cool, let me check this out. And I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be great because I can take the birds from this or the whales from this and sample it in my music and no one will ever really know.
Right.
But a lot of times those CDs or those albums have music underneath them, which is fine. No, I'm not knocking that. I'm just saying that I feel like there's a use for only the nature sounds. And when you give someone nature sounds, you don't want to hear it on a compressed MP3 coming out of someone's speakerphone on their phone. You want to hear it in the most high fidelity way that you possibly could. So, you know, you touched on the quality of the recording earlier, and that's a huge thing. Is you know, you could put it in A432 and have the best intention and have a great song and put it out there, and if you put out something that's just a compressed MP3 that's, you know, it compresses the quality, but it also compresses the sound healing potential. And I'm not sure if those are like relative to each other, you know, if it's five times less, is it five times less effective sound healing? But I do know that, you know, that really matters. And so I'm trying to put out super high quality nature samples that are super useful for people, a live sound healing album. And then, you know, I'm all over the place. I got asked to do this Christmas show at the Tudor House, and they said, okay, well, we want you to do sound for this, which to me, honestly, is, it's not that exciting, especially since I don't really do sound that often. And I don't really know their sound system that well. Like, I'll figure it out, you know, but for me, I'm just like, okay, yeah, I'll do it. I want to help my friends out. But then they said, okay, well, and if you have a song idea that might work well for the show, you know, maybe we can throw that in there. And, immediately after I got off the phone with her, I had this song idea, this Christmas song idea. It's called Last on His List. And it's about feeling like you're on last on Santa's list. You're feeling left out. And it's sort of a happy sounding Christmas song, but the lyrics are kind of sad. And and I'm loving it, and I'm recording it. And I'm doing that. And it's too late to put that out right now, but I'm going to put it out next Christmas. And I'm just like, you know, that's an A432. Of course, you know. And one thing I want to mention real quick before, I'm sorry I ramble sometimes.
No, it's fine. I got a question for you whenever you're okay. Ready for it.
This kitty likes to climb on my keyboard, but I don't like that. You know, I'm doing this Christmas song and I'm using these virtual instruments that are sampled. They're, you know, someone went around and sampled these amazing keyboards, and it's, you know, the grand piano sounds like you're at a grand piano. Anyways, I'm using A432, and they did an update to the thing recently, and some of my instruments will default back to A440. And sometimes I don't notice it. Sometimes it, because I have to change it each time I open the program, it seems like. So I'll export the mix, I'll listen back to it, and some of the chimes that are going on are in A440 and the rest of it's in A432. So it sounds a little off. But I'll tell you this much, when I switch it back to A432 and I listen to the mix back, not only is it in tune and it sounds better, which is like, duh, it is louder. It's louder, and I didn't adjust the volume at all. And it's because of that resonance.
Yeah. Yeah. 12, it's, you said, versus 8.
Right. It's resonating. Yeah. It's super in tune with everything that's going on. And because the waves are all in tune like that, they like amplify each other, you know, when something's so in tune like that, it's kind of like the concept of like, you know, people can break a glass with the, with their singing, if they, right. You're finding the resonant frequency of that object and you're matching that pitch. And if you intensely match that pitch with enough amplitude or with enough volume, it will break. And so it's kind of the same concept. If you just match the frequency of the song, it's all of a sudden like this nice, loud, full thing, you know?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that I feel like that can definitely happen. Like, even with our voices and conversation, like, have you ever met somebody who talks really fast or talks really loud? And like, all of a sudden you're talking fast and you're talking loud and like your frequencies are starting to like match each other and
totally
kind of get amplified, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
And when everything's all dissonant too, it actually winds up not being very loud, you know, because it's not resonant. I mean, you can have a lot of loud dissonance. I'm not saying that. It's just, it doesn't carry, you know, it's not in harmony. It's not in the flow. And when you have stuff that's in the flow or when it's in that frequency, it's just, it's more effective. It's more harmonious. It's it's better that way.
Awesome. Well, you know, it's, again, this juxtaposition of like going from drummer in a band, you know, playing at bars to moving towards music as a way to connect people and, you know, create more harmony in our physical experience, right?
Right.
This has to have arisen from something in you. I mean, you went through a yoga training, but more than that, there, you know, would you like to share with us any kind of story or experience that you went through that led you to feeling so compelled to do this kind of work, to be part of a healing community for others?
Yeah. You know, maybe it's just, you know, maybe it's just my wanting to help other people. And maybe that stems from like a lack of other people helping me, you know, like sort of like, I don't know. I lost my mom at the age of 18 to cancer. I'm not sure if that was part of it or if that like sparked more drive inside of me or what, but I think, you know, I remember distinctly back in high school at in the drum line, I was new in the drum line, and I think I was on the cymbal line. I might have been on the bass drum at that point, but I don't remember. But I remember you're standing at attention. It's just a rehearsal. But I remember our instructor, Phil, he asked everyone, "All right, who here wants to be the best?" And everyone raised their hand except for me. And he walked over to me and said, "Okay, why didn't you raise your hand? You don't want to be the best?" And I said, "No, I don't really care to be the best." And I don't know if I said I want to be different, but that's really what I should have said. And that's how I feel is, I don't want to be the best. And who's to say who's the best anyways? You know, I could say that who so-and-so is the best drummer, but then the next person next to me is going to say, "Well, no, I think this person's the best drummer, or this person's the best band," or whatever. It's kind of an opinion based thing,
right? And it's a competition based thing,
and it's competition based, exactly. And why do we need to be the best? Why do I need to outdo my neighbor? You know,
it's going back to hierarchical thinking versus like looking at other people as like, I guess not necessarily equals, but equal in terms of also being human beings, you know, with varying opinions and varying cultures and backgrounds and the things that we had, you know, that we came into the world with, our setup, all of that's perfectly like unique for each person. And at the same time, like we're equals in the sense that we're all like a person taking up a certain amount of space in the world, transmitting a certain type of energy. And this is a fundamental part of like most spiritual practices, is being able to see other people as your equal and treat them with that level of respect versus seeing everybody's competition, right? And seeing right. everybody as someone to overcome or someone to one up, right?
Right, right. And to me, you know, the best bands and the best albums even, and my, or I shouldn't even say the best, I should say my favorite bands and my favorite songs and my favorite things tend to be the second best ones. You know, they're not their best album, but I like their album before their best album, or after, you know, the one that people consider almost their best, but it's really different. It's really unique. It's really, they push the envelope, they challenge themselves, and out of it came something special that maybe not everyone, maybe it doesn't get onto the radio, or maybe, you know, they're not playing it every day, but I might, usually that's the type of stuff I enjoy. So tying that back in with the tuning, I think, you know, when you have to change the default tuning of your instrument, and when you're, you know, here's this younger drummer coming into the band and saying, I should tune my guitar differently. Like, who is this guy? You know, that's the reaction I've gotten. And it's part of it is like that rebelliousness, I guess you could say, is like, no, I'm not going to do the same thing you all have done for the past 100 years. Like, I want to do something different. And who's to say that, you know, I could be wrong about this whole thing. I could be wrong about A432 and everything, but I'm still in tune. Like, I'm still picking a tuning standard that's in tune, and I'm still using the musical laws and the, you know, the rules that we go through with rhythm and melody. I'm still using that, and it still sounds great. So who's to say that, that's wrong? It's just different, right? Mm-hmm. So even if it may not be better, which I truly believe it is, but even if it isn't, I'm just doing something different, you know, and that's part of it too. I'll say, hey guys, let's try this tuning, let's do something different. I don't want to do that, whatever their excuse is. It shows me right away, I get to see, oh, how open-minded is this person? And then that really actually kind of helps me with, like, you know, with musical decisions or songwriting, or, you know, because later on I might say, hey, what if we do this on the drums on this part? And they'll go, no, I don't want to do that because of that closed-mindedness.
Right.
So I'm partly testing the waters with seeing if they are even open-minded to trying it.
Yeah. And I mean, what you sound like and what you kind of expressed multiple times during this interview is that you really are here to innovate and to do something that breaks some new ground, you know, put something out into the world that like is unique and isn't just like right. everything else that's out there. And that's what I found so fascinating with the, you know, you have a recording out right now that I have listened to of your sound healing, and it's amazing, mm-hmm. really quite like unique.
Oh, thank you.
And so it's a soundscape, right? And it has these layers, but there's like this roundness to it that you've described. There's this wholeness to it. There's this big quality to it, you know, and mm-hmm. when you hear it, you kind of like, are like, oh man, like I can tell that would be really powerful live, you know, in the right kind of space to like amplify that sound, you know. And coming back to, you know, some of the things you said about losing your mother and about, you know, being someone who was not necessarily helped maybe at different times when you needed help, mm-hmm. and that actually motivating you to help other people. I think that's really quite an interesting thing, because we don't necessarily realize it while we're in it, but going through grief and hardship and having like the world or the universe kind of take something from us, right? It brings a lot of compassion and a lot of respect, honestly, for life, or it can, it has the capacity to do that. And, mm-hmm. and it can be over time, you know, grief feels like a weight in our bodies, and it feels like kind of this black hole sucking inward, right?
Right.
But as we learn to actually compassionately handle our own grief, or even receive that compassionate handling from other people, what I've experienced is that more and more we can build, you know, a simultaneous level of compassion as we are moving through and experiencing the waves and the undulations of something as heavy as grief, right? And so it doesn't surprise me that you say that was part of your healing and kind of like heart opening awakening journey to lose your mother, you know, which I'm so sad for you. Sorry for the 18-year-old you that had to go through that. You know, nobody wants to lose their mother, but well, maybe some people do, but not, I think you're one of those people. So, you know, I feel for that experience. And you know, it's part of what you're doing now in its own way, if that makes sense.
Totally. And you know, when I do these sound baths, I used to just play the music, like minimal talking, you know, okay, relax, lay down. Okay, let's go. And fill the time with sound, you know, then I went to the sound healer who she left about a half hour. I'm not kidding you. It was like 20 minutes plus of silence, you know, not ending it with silence, you know, bringing it back. But there was a period of like, I was going like, wow, you're getting paid right now to do nothing, like literally, like, and I learned from that, like there is an aspect of silence that needs to be along with the sound, along with the healing, along with the giving of the frequencies, there needs to be the silence part. So I've been incorporating that into the sessions, but another part of it is incorporating some sort of intention or some sort of connection to your family or your friends or a value in your life that, or something you've been working on, you know, and hold on just a second. There we go. If I don't connect that intention, if I don't talk a little bit, if I don't tell people that they need to imagine someone that they love and to send that love to them or whatever, you know, the meditation part of it is, I don't get people crying. I'm not trying to make people cry, but you know, you're touching on grief, and we're touching on like deeper traumas sometimes when we do these sound things, because it gets you down into those lower alpha and lower, like I think it's theta brain patterns, and you're also so relaxed, and you know, there's just this. You sometimes tap into those traumas, or sometimes you tap into those griefs, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, right? Because we all need to process those things. And so part of doing these sound healing events is trying to make that connection with people, but more so they're making a connection with themselves, or they're making a connection with that loved one that they lost, or with their husband who is having a hard time, or with their son who's going through drugs or whatever. And when you invoke that connection, intention, and then the music all at the same time, it's really powerful. And it's no wonder why some people leave in tears, or, you know, want to just give me a hug afterwards. And that's the real connection part that we're talking about. And the only time I ever get tears when I'm playing in a bar is if they're so drunk that they're crying, you know. It's totally,
they fall over and smash their face.
right. And instead I'm making a real connection with this person. They've made a real connection with something in their lives, and at the very least they're at a space for an hour that's safe and relaxing. And the tones are relaxing, whether it's an A440 or A432, you know, the music is soothing. But like I said, when you make it high quality, when you have high fidelity music, when you put it in A432, when maybe you use some form of brainwave entrainment, when you connect the intention, when you get all the pieces to the puzzle going and you deliver that in person, it's a really powerful thing, and it's much more powerful than just background music at a venue to me.
Right.
And so so my life is totally just pointed that direction now. I'm fully committed, and I'm really excited for this next year, actually.
Beautiful. And that what you do, what you're describing that you would do it to connect everybody at the beginning of a session, or, you know, at some point during the sound healing session, I'm supposing it's at the beginning, you really are calling them into loving kindness. You're calling them into a metta type of meditation, where that's a very powerful frequency that you're inviting their bodies to start emitting into the space, which is compassion for other beings. Right. Maybe it's for themselves, maybe it's for someone else in their life. Right. So I think that's just fantastic. I think that's totally where it's at, especially when you're really trying to create a space of safety through the music, through the energy in the room, by connecting people to that kind of loving kindness and heart space. So bravo. I wanted to touch on something that you said earlier that I thought was fascinating. It was almost in the same sentence. You said, I'm not particularly sensitive to energy. I wish I was. And then you described these pockets.
Being sensitive to energy.
these pockets of energy. And maybe another way to put it, you know, because everything is energy, is that maybe you're not sensitive to energy in terms of like the chakras or like seeing auras or something. Maybe your way of being sensitive to energy is being sensitive to sound. Because you are definitely sensitive to sound, if you can tell when the chimes are off by 8 hertz in your.
That's interesting. I never really thought of that way. And I like that. I really appreciate you saying that. I think you're right. I think I have the ability to be sensitive with sound, and even with touch and feeling, because when you're using the tuning forks, you know, it feels like there's a magnet pushing against your tuning fork in certain specific areas. That's the closest feeling I can relate it to. And I'm sure other people feel that too and hear that too, but that's really cool. Yeah. You know, I was talking about it with my landlord recently, and she said, you know, yeah, you're special. You know, not everyone goes to the grocery store and wears earplugs. because I do most of the time. It's kind of this overwhelming experience where there's the music's a little too loud, the beeping from the checkers is too loud, the people are talking a little, someone's on their phone, and I guess I'm just sensitive to sound. So that's my gift. Yay.
Right. Yeah. And then looking at that way the tuning forks create those bubbles, I thought that was also kind of like fascinating. Like you're describing being able to feel like this pushback. Right. And I've been exploring this with a few different ways. This was kind of the thing that was like earlier in my head. I was like, whoa, putting things together. But when certain experiences and certain things happen, different kinds of traumas, whether it's a physical trauma, like twisting your ankle or breaking your leg, or whether it's an emotional or psychological kind of trauma, some kind of life experience, right? What I have found in my own kind of intuitive studies and learning, and then what I've heard from various other people, is that we can create like these, I would say like leaks or gaps in our aura. Some people have even talked about specifically like drugs and alcohol and certain kinds of substances creating like these cracks or these breakages in our auric field that are then we're losing energy through this, because there's been some kind of like structural damage to our biofield.
Right.
And that was what I immediately thought of when you were describing your friend and her knee and the tuning forks and the way you could feel this pushing back. It's like you've come to a breakage point. You've come to a space in the biofield that has some damage, and you're feeling their life force pushing back out. And you're just like receiving that as, you know, maybe a feeling, or, you know, I've had it at different times where like I'm working with someone and I feel like it's like their memory like comes in. And I have like a flash of something that probably happened to them. And it's totally weird stuff. I don't talk about it that often, but I've
definitely that's really interesting
experiences where it's like, I get this like flash of like something that happened once upon a time you know, and it's a momentary thing, like a flash in a dream. And I feel like we're talking about the same thing when we're talking about this, like, breakage in the aura and the energy coming out, and it's being received by others. It's being felt, right, by others in the other field. That's how you know, you can tell when someone has been through something, you know, when someone's in a dark place and there's this, like, you know, you can feel that just by looking at them, right? By being in their presence. So I don't know if you've ever heard about any of this stuff that I'm talking about
these a little bit,
but there are things we can do, like what you're doing with the sound healing, what you're doing with the tuning forks at this healing frequency, this frequency of the universe, right? Mm-hmm. You are helping to fortify and rebuild and mend those breakages in our biofield.
Right.
That's what came to me really clearly while we were talking.
Yes. Yes, totally. Dr. Eileen McCusick is probably the best example of this. She can put you on a table, do the tuning forks on you, wave it over your body for a little bit and go, did you have an issue when you were about 7 years old with your dad involving, like, moving forward in your life? And you'll be like, oh my gosh, when I was seven, you know, my dad had, like, left and we were going to move to this new place. And she can diagnose the body based on these pockets of trauma inside of our aura or inside of our, you know, our biofield or our electromagnetic field, whatever you want to call it. It's the 6-foot energy field around us that you can't see. And we're interacting with it all the time. And when we, you know, and it's interesting that it's 6 feet, because if you think about COVID, they're like, okay, keep your 6-foot distance. Well, I can't help but think, like, if your biofield is 6 feet and there's a six, you know, they don't want our fields interacting for whatever reason. And that could be good or bad. But Dr. Eileen McCusick also has a theory that our memories are stored in our biofield. And
I've heard about this kind of stuff too, about the memories. And that's part of what I think I've experienced when working with people, right? Is this, you know, and that's something, you know, for me personally, I do this somatic work in person, like hands-on, and then I also do it over Zoom. And what I've found is very fascinating by doing the work over Zoom is just, like, that little bit of space that we're, like, creating in the sense that we're still connecting. Like, you and I are here, we're sharing the frequencies of our voice, we're looking at the expressions on each other's faces. Like, I've met you before in person, so there's definitely, like, a blending of our auras on an astral plane, but it's not the same as being in person. And so there's this kind of almost like, this is a kind of a crude, it's kind of a crude way of putting it, but it's almost like there's, like, a condom or something, like, we're a little protected from that really direct, like, influx of, like, whatever my biofield, the memories and the traumas and the things, right? They're not so directly coming into yours and blending, because we have this little bit of distance of the electronic, you know, system. It's not to say that we still can't tap into those things, but we have to do it a bit more intentionally, I think.
Totally.
Work with an astral, like, technological plane versus in person, it's just happening. Like, we can't really stop it totally, you know?
Right. And, you know, and one thing I want to touch on real quick is, like, you know, when you talk about the technological plane and all of that, you know, at that point we're in digital. We're dealing with zeros and ones. We're dealing with something that is now measurable as far as quality goes. You know, when you have a 1080p monitor, or when you have a song that's 44.1 kilohertz, you know, sample rate, these are all measurable things because we've digitized them. You and I have digitized the screen right now, and we're going over an internet connection. When you do that, you almost always lose quality, no matter how high of a connection you have. When you're, you know, when they measure music on tape, you can't measure the bit rate and the sample bit depth and the sample rate, which is basically the range of frequencies from bit depth is the volume from the lowest whisper to the loudest thing, and the sample rate is the lowest bass frequency to the highest treble frequency. And so we use those two pieces of information when we talk about digital music or movies or whatnot. And you can record in really, 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 really high quality. Like, I mean, that's what I'm doing digitally right now. But the best way to do it is analog. The best way to do it is on tape. The best way to do it is in person, like what you're saying with your clients. You can't measure it at that point. It's infinite bit depth. It's infinite sample rate. It's infinite. There's an infinite range of colors that I'm seeing from your face. There's an infinite, you know, it's life. That's real organic life versus, like a visual representation or an audio representation of life. So that's why I think, you know, I'll keep doing at least a sound bath a month is what I'm planning on doing alongside of releasing these recordings. So that way I can have that in-person connection, but I can also release these really high quality digital recordings that people can enjoy on their own time.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree with everything you said, and that infinite quality of what it is like to stand in front of another person. I mean, I think everybody can connect with that, like knows exactly what you're talking about, because there is that, you know, to be in like the presence of another person, especially if it's someone who, you know, is expressing or sharing or caring or nurturing for you in some way, is a powerful experience, right? But at the same time, what's sort of fascinating about this, you know, internet work that I'm doing is that sometimes, especially given like the very sensitive nature of this work, there are people who I think do better with it, with that like little bit of distance, kind of like I think therapy has actually gotten more people to go to therapy, you know, because they don't have to leave their house and walk into a building that says, you know, psychologist on it. You know, they can just be in the comfort of their own space, and they don't have to have that kind of like confrontational experience of being in that infinite space with someone. Right. And for me, with the hands-on work, you know, I had a client recently who he told me like a couple of minutes into the session, and I mean, I could already tell, but like, he just told me that it had been like 6 years since anybody had touched him. And I was like, whoa, you know, like I could kind of feel that, but it brought like an awareness to me of like, for some people, it can be a really big deal to have someone put their hands on them and do this kind of work. And so there's a certain level of, I feel like, accessibility that being able to work with me over Zoom and still get like really amazing, fantastic healing benefits from the somatic. Oh, totally. It has its own benefit in its own way.
Totally. Totally. You
know, in the same way as like, not everybody's going to go to a sound bath, but they might look up some relaxing music and find your music online, and it might really soothe them and help them, and they might really connect with it, but they wouldn't be the type of person who would feel comfortable walking into a yoga studio for a sound bath.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about, you know, using the tools we have in the moment, you know, and using the technology that we have and delivering the highest quality that we can in that moment, you know? And so, for me, that starts with the tuning. That's a huge quality thing. And a lot of musicians, they bypass step one. They just go concert standard. Okay, we're good. And now let's record. And then when you record, you have to record at really high quality if you're going digital, or you have to record on tape. I mean, those are, you're competing. Unfortunately, you know, we talked about competition, but at a certain point you are competing with other sound healing musicians in the world. If you're putting out music, or, you know, you're competing with whoever is in your art field. So it's you have to give it the best shot, and the best shot is putting out the highest quality product that you can, whether that's in person or, you know, not in person.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what I think success comes from, like true success, like success that's not just measured by money or metrics or likes on the internet or whatever, but true success that we can feel like satisfaction inside of ourselves, that perhaps is also mirrored in the world. It comes from a place of doing our utmost, of actually delivering something that we feel is in full integrity, right? As a healer, as a musician, or as, you know, a therapist, or as an artist, like you want to deliver something that is truly like authentic and honest and utmost is the word that keeps coming to my mind about it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And some of these things are etched into time, you know, or they're etched into a vinyl record or a CD or a sound recording that you really, you don't get another chance to go back and do that over. And same thing with when you're working with someone in person in that moment, especially, like, you don't get to do that moment over. You know, if you're walking around with a tuning fork and you accidentally drop it on their face or step on their finger, that's not a good, they're going to remember that, you know, and that moment is kind of etched in time. And so, giving your utmost in that moment, it's so important because you don't get another chance. You don't get another try. And, you know, with recording, you can do multiple takes and perfect things, which is partly why I like that. I like that you can craft these beautiful pieces of art and then put it out there. And it's not so in the moment, like playing in a band where it's just, oh, here you go. Here's what it is. So I feel like, you know, with that craft, you can really hone in and make this really effective piece of art for someone that can last the test of time, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the bigger vision, right? Is reaching a larger audience with something that's really from you in this authentic utmost way, and then having it live on, like as a legacy or something like that, you know, that's what we have when we listen to classical music like Beethoven, or, you know, these different songs that have been around for hundreds of years, folk songs from, you know, different parts of the world, or, you know, rhythms that, you know, are being drummed out, and, you know, music that's been being played for thousands of years. It has like this certain quality to it, right? Of just this like legacy. And then these little smaller legacies are being created all the time by other humans, by other groups of people who are forming something. And so, you know,
yeah, I think, and it all inspires the next thing too.
Absolutely. So this is wonderful. I'll be so excited to check in with you and have another interview at some point. We can check in with how it's going with your recording. Definitely, there will be, for the listeners, there's going to be information about Stephen Rubio and his music in the show notes. But maybe you also want to tell people where they can find you, where they could interact with you, maybe where they could download a song.
Sure. So I came out with a meditation album recently called Soulscapes. It's out on all the different platforms. So you can search Stephen Rubio Soulscapes. And each of all of the tracks have mono beats in them. And it, except for one of them, which is just, I had a mono beat in there, and it was a rainstorm. It was a live thunderstorm that I recorded up here, and it was just actually a little bit distracting from the rainstorm, so I wound up taking that out. But essentially every track's in A432, every track's in Ultra HD, every track has a mono beat, and I really made it, I tried to just make it simple and try to make it this nice meditation album. So you can find that on all the different platforms. If you feel like connecting on Facebook, it's facebook.com/soundwithsteve. And the bigger thing I'm going to be pushing this next year is my Instagram, which is 432 Hertz Sound Baths. I'm going to be putting out a post a day. I'm going to be putting out lots of new videos and talking about albums and songs that are already in A432 Hertz that you never knew. I'm going to be talking about music that I like. I'm going to be showing off some of my weird instruments. I'm going to be doing a bunch of different things with that channel. So 432 Hertz Sound Baths on Instagram.
Sweet. Oh, thank you so much. This has been such a fascinating conversation. I have learned so much about instruments and sound and a lot about, you know, what you do and kind of what you're bringing to the table when it comes to creating an innovative sound bath. So thank you for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this. It was great.
Excellent. Well, I'll be, you know, Stephen and I are practically neighbors. We live on the same mountain. So I'll see you on the mountain.
I'll see you around. See you at Stater Brothers.
Perfect.
Thanks, Amy.
You've been listening to the Free Your Soma podcast. To find out more information about today's guest, check the show notes. And to find out more information about me, Amy Takaya, and the Radiance Program, visit www.freeyoursoma.com.